So the title of my talk is going to be Effective Field Theories and Supersymmetry Breaking in 2B Warp Compactifications. And I'll try and summarize the results of these two papers. First, the first one written with Andrew Frey this March, and the second one written this October with Cliff Burgess, Pablo Camara, Shanta D'Alvis, Steve Giddings, Fernando Quevedo, and Karim Shurlitz. I will be using some material from this paper with Steve from last year, which I'll briefly review when required. So let me begin by saying a few words about the motivation for doing this. So recent developments in flux compactifications require us to develop a systematic understanding of the space of flux vacua and the properties of these vacua. And warping is one of the many aspects that require study. And there are good reasons to do this, because firstly, warping is generic in flux compactifications, and also warping finds a large number of phenomenological applications. So I'll discuss the steps taken in understanding the mass scales, the implications for 4D effective field theory, SUSY breaking, incorporating the effects of warping. Well, it's if one analyzes the equations of motion, then one sees that one typically gets a warp factor. So the plan of the talk is going to be follows. I'll first review 2B flux compactifications and some essential background. Then I'll move on to discussing warping and Kaluza-Klein reduction, discuss some implications for 4D effective field theory, then discuss SUSY breaking, and finish with a summary. So I will work in the context of 2B flux compactifications. And the reason for doing that is that we have explicit solutions available, and it's just much more easier to do an analysis. So let me start by describing those solutions. To obtain a solution, one has to specify some data. And firstly, one needs to specify orientifold of a Calabiau. This, in general, will come with its moduli, some complex structure, and Kähler moduli. More generally, one can have an F-theory base, but I'll confine myself to the Calabiau case. Then one has to specify closed three-form fluxes threading the three cycles of this Calabiau, which satisfy usual Dirac quantization conditions. One then has to specify positions of D3 brains, which are point-like on this Calabiau. Finally, the fluxes and the D3 charge have to satisfy the analog of a Gauss law constraint, which essentially comes from the fact that there can be no net D3 charge on the internal manifold. So given this data, it's possible to write down the metric in a fairly explicit form. The metric is a warped compactification with the internal manifold conformal to the underlying Calabiau. And the warp factor itself is determined by a Poisson type equation, which is sourced by the three-form flux and the free brain charge. Furthermore, the metric and the dilaton have to be such that the free-form flux is imaginary self-dual, and because of the dependence through the Hodge dual, this imposes a condition on the metric, and this fixes the values of the complex structure moduli and the dilaton. As a result, the number of 4D massless degrees of freedom are reduced. Now, another attractive feature of these solutions is that one can generate large but finite redshifts between points on the internal manifold. So for instance, if there's a conifold singularity on the Calabi-Yau, and much like the Klebanov-Stresler solution, if one chooses m units of F3 flux and k units of H3 flux on the A and B cycle, the conifold gets deformed, and the Whorf factor takes a finite minimum value, which I shall call am, and this can be exponentially small in the integer choice of fluxes. This gives us the following picture of these compactifications. One has a region, which I shall refer to the bulk, where the local geometry is Calabi-Yau times Minkowski. The Whorf factor is almost a constant in this bulk region, and this bulk typically has large volume in string units. And then there's a region where the local geometry is ADS5 times X5. These I will call throats, and typically the throats occupy a small fraction of the net volume of the space. These can be thought of the realization of Randall-Sundrum models in string theory, and studies have been carried out on the statistics of these throats, and they have shown that such throats are fairly generic in these 2B compactifications. And in fact, typically one expects multiple throats in a given compactification. So before going on to discussing the effects of warping, I would like to review the nature of the volume modulus in these compactifications, because it's closely connected to warping. So as we saw, that the Kähler moduli are unfixed, but for the universal Kähler modulus, there is a slight subtlety. When one scales the internal manifold, the equation determining the Whorf factor requires e to the power of minus 2a to change in precisely the inverse manner as the scaling. As a result, e to the power of minus 2ag tilde mn, which is the internal manifold, remains unchanged. And the modulus is actually associated with the freedom to add a homogeneous part here, that is just shifting e to the power of minus 4a by a constant. A particularly useful convention to fix the particular part of the solution is that you choose the particular part, e to the power of minus a naught, which although I denote by an exponential can take negative values, by requiring that it is orthogonal to the constant mode. And if one fixes the particular part by this, then the Einstein frame metric takes the following form. C is the volume in goes as 2/3 powers of the volume in string unit, and the function e to the power of minus 4a naught tends to order 1 in the bulk. Now, two things that I'd like to note here, which will be important for us later, is that throats are regions where e to the power of minus 4a naught is much, much greater than C. Therefore, the throat geometry is independent of the volume modulo this scaling associated with going to the Einstein frame. And secondly, the relative redshift, which is the ratio of this prefactor in front of the Minkowski metric, has volume dependence. And for C going to infinity, or C much, much greater than e to the power of minus 4 am, the relative redshift goes to unity, and there are no throats. So therefore, if we want to understand the effects of throats in the 4D effective field theory, we really have to understand finite volume effects. In general, the hierarchy depends on the volume and scales as the inverse of square root of C. So working in a limit where we drop the Wharf factor is in this limit of C much, much greater than e to the power of minus am. And in this limit, the effective field theory has been very well studied. The moduli dynamics is governed by the Gugow-Wafa-Witten superpotential. And the Kähler potential is the standard Kähler potential on a collabial, as was shown by GKP. And furthermore, soft supersymmetry breaking terms on both D3 and D7 brains have been also studied by various groups. So in some sense, what we'll try and understand today is what happens when one goes to smaller volumes, in particular when the volume is made so small as there are throats in the compactification. Now, two things to remember while that went into these derivations is that the wave function of the excitations in the internal directions were taken to be same as the zero flux case. And the mass of the moduli scaled as 1 over volume in the Einstein frame, and the Kaluza-Klein modes as 1 over volume to the power of 2/3. So there was a parametric separation between those two scales.
Actually, I'm a little confused by your statement about the mass. Mm-hmm. I thought the mass of the moduli went like alpha prime over some radius cubed.
That's in the frame when the Kaluza-Klein mass goes as 1 by r. So if you go to the Einstein frame, there's a 1 over r cubed. So it's a 1 over r to the power of 6, and it's a 1 over volume.
Ratio should be the same.
Yeah, ratio. So ratio, I had a 1 over v to the power of 1/3, and then that's 1 over r squared. Okay, so now let me come to discussing warping and Kaluza-Klein reduction. So this effectively amounts to looking at linearized fluctuations about this background, considering constructing the Lichnorowicz operator and trying to determine its spectrum. In practice, one encounters many subtleties. And these were discussed in this paper with Steve, but I will only give a qualitative description of the relevant facts using the dilaton. So when one analyzes these equations, one finds that a true eigenfunction of the new Lichnorowicz operator is no longer the zero mode on the internal underlying collabial. So that is, if one takes the new eigenfunction and carries out a harmonic decomposition with the harmonics of G tilde, one finds that there are components of the Kaluza-Klein modes. One also finds that there is mixing between the complex structure moduli and the dilaton. One finds that there is mixing between the exact part of the fluxes and the dilaton. Now, these statements should not be a surprise, because once these modes are massive, they are no longer supersymmetric excitations, and one does not expect any kind of protection for their wave functions. But what one can do is that one when one has small or moderate warping, which I shall qualify later, one can organize all these effects in a systematic 1 over C expansion. But the when one enters the regime of large warping, particularly with throats, one finds that this expansion becomes unreliable, and particularly when e to the power of my, the reason for that being is that because when one has throats, we saw that there are regions where e to the power of minus 4a is much, much greater than c, and therefore one is not able to use 1 over c as an expansion parameter. Related to this, one finds very strong mixing between the zero mode and the Kaluza-Klein modes that I discussed here, and this might seem a disturbing feature from the perspective of the 4D effective field theory, because one would think that these Kaluza-Klein modes are very heavy and should drop out in the low energy dynamics.
The, Yes,
and I think we'll see the reason for this. I'm just saying that if one naively goes about carrying these expansions, these are the features that one finds, and we will see what this actually means from the perspective of supergravity. Just okay. Yes, it will be. I'm just saying that this might seem that when one sees all this mixing, it might seem, and we'll see what this means later on. So what what one learns from this is that to understand the spectrum, the expansion around large volume might not be a simple expansion in 1 over C. There might be subtleties, and one actually needs to try and explicitly understand the Lichnerovich operator. So that is what we did in this paper with Andrew Frey. And to gain intuition for the spectrum in the presence of throats, I will describe in some detail a very simple toy example, which is a scalar in five dimensions. The extra dimension is phi, it runs between 0 and r, and the warp factor is just a step function. If a phi is 0 between l over r, and it takes e to the power of minus h between 0 and l. So these I'll call region 1 and 2. For L by R much, much less than 1, and H much, much greater than 1, this region qualifies to be called a throat, and this region a bulk. So what we did is that we considered a scalar tau with 5D mass M propagating in this space with Neumann boundary conditions. If one wants a periodic space, one can just reflect about phi equals to 0. Okay, so we dimensionally reduce in the phi directions. Let's call the wave function in the internal directions tau and phi, and the allowed 4D masses, m and phi. So this leads to the following eigenvalue problem for tau n and m n. And the only difference in region 1 and 2 arises from the extra factor of e to the power of 2h in region 1. Now, if one looks at the system, it seems very similar to the square well problem in quantum mechanics. And therefore, in particular, one can have modes for which mn square e to the power of minus 2h minus m square is greater than 0 but the analogous quantity in the bulk is negative. So these modes are oscillatory only in the throat regions, and these I will term as localized modes. Of course, one can have modes which are oscillatory in both of the regions, and those I will call bulk modes. So, as in quantum mechanics, you can write down equations using the matching conditions at the interface, which determine the 4D masses. But the spectrum is best understood in terms of plot, which I will show next. Okay. So, in this plot, X is a function of the four-dimensional mass, small m. And there are three functions plotted. The first one is y of x, which is almost like a tan x. And then one has yb of x, which is a squashed ellipse ending at x equals to x hat. And those are the broad dashes. And then I have yc of x, which behaves like negative of tan x, and those are the shorter dashed lines. And whenever I have an intersection between the dashes and the bold, I have an allowed value for m in the 4D theory. So, and the purple intersections between yb and ya are the localized modes, and the green intersections, which are between yc and YA, are the bulk modes. And then there, as I said, there is a crossover point, a point where X hat, where YB ends and YC starts. This is the crossover between the localized and bulk modes. One can write an expression for X hat in terms of the warping and L and M. And the lesson to take from this example is that when the warping is increased, x hat continuously moves to the right. And as a result, bulk modes are smoothly converted into localized modes. That is, if you increase the warping, which is analogous of decreasing the volume in the 2B compactifications, more and more bulk modes smoothly get converted, get sucked down into the throat. So now the spectrum can be understood from the following formula, and where xn are the intersection points. And since we saw that ya had the structure of tan x, there is almost a single intersection at every interval of pi. And if one wants to very crudely model string throats, then the relevant regime to work in is when m times l is of order 1, which amounts to the statement that both the ADS radius of the throat and the flux mass terms are both set by integer fluxes in the throat. Then what one finds is that the mass of the lowest mode is redshifted. Then also the gap divided by this mass of the lowest mode is of order unity. And the low-lying spectrum is highly localized. And the number of modes that get sucked in for some large warping is very high. In fact, it's almost equal to the integer part of the maximum warping. What I will do next is study the dilaton dynamics in 2B flux vacua, and we are going to find very similar features.
Yes. The distinction between this toy model that you've gone over so far and the Randall-Sundrum toy model that you have is bulk.
Yeah, that's.
And if you had done Randall-Sundrum, but just put some boundary conditions in the bulk brain or whatever,
yeah.
Would some choice of boundary conditions be?
Yeah, you would. I mean, the only reason why I put a bulk, because in the in the 2B fluxes, you have a bulk. So, and we'll see the relationship with the Randall syndrome.
You wouldn't really have the bulk in that case, right?
You could just say they're localized on the plane brain.
Yeah.
Say that.
Question?
Yeah.
I mean, the dilaton is special in that in the leading approximation, its wave function is a constant over the body.
Yeah.
So it's sort of in the throat and it's in the bulk. You could imagine there are moduli like associated to cycles of the clavio.
Yeah.
Essentially live all in the bulk.
Yeah.
Or all in the throat.
Yeah.
For those, would the conclusions be qualitatively different?
Yeah, I think that for a general cycle, the conclusion would be qualitatively different. But you know, if there are some cycles which have some support in some throat, there is the possibility. So it's very hard to make, you know, if there are two throats and if you have the conifold modulus of one of the throats, you don't expect it to get sucked into the other one. So okay, let me come to the dynamics of the. Dilaton. Now, to make the analysis tractable, what I shall do is I shall assume dependence on a single radial direction, the direction in which the Whorf factor varies, and I will ignore mixing between the various modes that I talked about. That's for now. So under these assumptions, one can write down the equation for describing the fluctuation of the dilaton, and one finds the following equation, where M4 is the four-dimensional mass of the dilaton. And after doing some variable changes, which are rescalings of the radial direction and the wave function, one finds that this can be put in the Schrodinger form, with the mass being the energy being equal to the 4D mass, and the potential having two terms. One, the one function of the Whorf factor, and the second, contribution from the fluxes. Now, it's a good check on our modeling to see that if you set this term to zero, one recovers a mode with zero mass, which corresponds to the fact that we should have a massless mode in the absence of any fluxes. Okay, so as I said, the potential has two pieces, one from the Whorf factor and one from the fluxes, but they are local functions of the Whorf factor and the fluxes. Therefore, to do the first estimate, one can use semi-classical estimates. So there are various known throat geometries, the one written by Klebanov and Seitlin, and more recently there have been ones written by Sebastian Franco and collaborator. And if one assumes that a wave function is localized in the infrared of the end of the throat, one finds that the energy scales as 2 powers of the minimum Whorf factor. Then one has 2/3 powers of the inverse volume, and one has a contribution from a flux quantum, which sets the size of the infrared end of the throat. In the bulk, the Whorf factor is almost a constant, and one can use the scaling properties of the flux term to determine the associated energy, and that goes as 1 over volume squared. So what one finds, that there is a competition between the Whorf factor and the volume. For the maximal Whorf factor greater than 2/3 powers of the volume, and I shall call this condition the regime of strong warping from now on, the wave functions localize and their mass is redshifted by the minimum value of the Whorf factor. So what we did in this paper with Andrew Frey is that we took various models for the throat geometry. We looked throats attached to flat space. We also incorporated the mixing between the dilaton and the fluxes using numerical methods. And in all cases, we found that this result seems to be robust. So now, so what it seems is that in this regime, the behavior is very similar to the work of Goldberger and Weiss, who studied the dynamics of a massive bulk scalar in an RS model. But for and in this region, one can precisely forget the bulk. But for larger volumes, one smoothly interpolates to the other behavior. So let me quickly summarize what we learned about the spectrum and wave function. For C much, much greater than e to the power of minus 4 am, the Dilaton wave function is uniformly spread. The mass goes as 1 over volume, and is parametrically separated from the Kaluza-Klein scale. Now imagine decreasing C adiabatically, and as a result, the wave function and the masses change continuously. For C less than e to the power of minus 4 am, a throat develops, and when C is less than just e to the power of minus am, then the wave functions are localized. The Dilaton mass is redshifted, and same as the Kaluza-Klein scale, and this differs from the warped string scale only by a factor of GS and to 1/3 power of the volume. Now, this behavior of the spectrum might seem in contradiction from the scaling of various terms in the 2B action, but as we saw, that throats are precisely regions in the solution which are independent of the volume, so the scaling arguments do not apply when one is particular, one is in this regime. Now a few comments about the 4D effective field theory in the strong warping regime. Firstly, the Gukov Wafa-Witten superpotential is supposed to describe the dynamics of the moduli with other modes integrated out. And what we saw is that there is the localization of wave functions under a adiabatic change in the volume. And this suggests that the Gukov Wafa-Witten superpotential be valid for the lightest modes, which are localized in the longest throats. But we also found that the gap is of order 1. And for that, one would need to integrate these out along with the Kaluza-Klein modes for a consistent truncation, leaving just the classically massless scalar moduli, as was done in KKLT. Now, now I would also like to comment about this mixing that we saw earlier on. And now this mixing actually seems energetically favorable, because what we found is that the wave functions were localized. And if one carries out a Fourier decomposition of a localized function, then one typically expects all the harmonics to be present, and there is energy gain by localization in the highly warped region. So this condition that we derived can be thought as a competition between the energy gained by localization and the cost of exciting Kaluza-Klein modes of the metric G tilde Mn. Now let me move on to the subject of supersymmetry breaking. And recall that a supersymmetry is broken by free zero flux, and the gravitino acquires a mass by the super Higgs effect. So to understand supersymmetry breaking, we first started by analyzing the 2B gravitino equations of motion, including the effects of warping. Although this set looks quite complicated, after estimating the size of various terms and taking into account some mixing between the 10D modes, one can write down the relevant dynamical equation which determines the gravitino mass. And what one finds is that both the mass term and the kinetic terms precisely scale as the square root of the ones that we saw in the case of the dilaton, and as is expected from a fermionic equation. So again, one has the fact that for the case of strong warping, the gravitino mass gets localized. So one can alternatively think of this as the fact that the least broken supersymmetry varies with the volume and becomes localized as one shrinks the volume. And also, this is same as the Kaluza-Klein scale. The other gravitini are also in the same scale, the ones that are the higher harmonics. So one is obviously led to the question that can we use an n equals to 1, d equals to 4 supergravity formalism to describe the dynamics. And of course, generically, the answer to the question is no, because one cannot consistently truncate, but one can exploit the existence of a supersymmetric limit in which the Gukov-Wafa-Witten superpotential goes to zero. And we know that in this limit, the lightest gravitino goes to zero, while the other gravitini remain at the Kaluza-Klein scale. So one can think of working in the supersymmetric limit and thereby have a parametrically light lowest gravitino.
Is the warping in unaffected essentially in this W not goes to zero limit, or is this?
You can have throats where there's no like the supersymmetry breaking fluxes. So
okay.
Now, so recall that in KKLT, one is already working in the W naught going to zero limit, but for a different reason. That is because one wants to control the alpha prime corrections in the Kähler potential.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I think this is actually a question Ivo was asking earlier. When you say that M3 halves is coming down to the KK scale,
mm-hmm.
you mean KK modes in the throat.
Yes.
And so there's a bulk KK scale in the sort of
Kähler,
which is much higher.
Yes.
So couldn't we go back to her statement that you could sort of four square in the throat and view this whole thing as a 4D conformal field theory coupled to gravity? And in that very complicated language, there should be a 4D effective supersymmetric description anyway.
Yes, but I think that like for the one would also have to worry of the suppose one was trying to study supersymmetry breaking of some brain localized in the bulk. I mean, it's not clear that the throat modes don't have any effect. I mean, one would see it in this conformal field theory picture, but I mean, since there are a large number of throat modes, so it's not clear that one can neglect them in an analysis and just treat them as two different sectors.
Anyway, practically what I said is useful. So.
Yes. Okay, so having learned what we have learned from the dynamics of the moduli and the gravitino, let's try and see what we can say about the Kähler potential. So in large volume, while using this formula, so in large volume, M3 by 2 behaves as follows, goes as 1 over volume. And from this formula, one learns that K goes as minus 2 log V, which when written in terms of the correct holomorphic coordinates is minus 3 log rho plus rho bar. Now, in this strong warping regime, we have M3 by 2 is e to the power of minus AM divided by V to the power of 1/3. And plugging that into this formula, one would conclude that K is e to the power, has a linear piece in AM and goes as 2/3 log V. So in general, one expects an interpolating formula between these two, and one expects the strength of the expansion parameter to be of this order, because this is precisely when one starts seeing a qualitative distinct behavior from this. And we tried writing down interpolations. In fact, we could write many interpolations, but we don't have a particular reason to believe that any one of them is right. So we, from now on, I will kind of work in this very, very strongly warp regime. And when needed, I'll use this formula for the Kähler potential. Now, this, of course, raises a puzzle. In the sense that for this strong warping, this Kähler potential does not seem to respect the no-scale structure which these compactifications have, and the resolution that we could think of that for that is that in the case of strong warping, one expects very important corrections to holomorphic coordinates, which might make this consistent with the no-scale structure. So now I will study supersymmetry breaking in the microscopic theory for brain matter in D3 and D7.
Can you say it again, where the no-scale broke down? Is this a matter of alpha protractions?
No, this is not a matter of alpha prime corrections, because so.
There's no flux in there.
It's an alpha prime correction. It's alpha prime corrections, where n is flux one. So we usually keep the head alpha prime corrections working. We drop the alpha prime.
So it's a
But I mean, at the end of it, I don't think that, you know, I think that we're not saying that the no scale structure broke down. All we're saying is that if I look at this formula for the Kähler potential, and I do the K, if I write down the standard K A B bar del A K del B bar K, I find it to be 3, okay? With the definition that I have to change, I have to write V as rho. Now, I don't know what rho is in this regime, and therefore I am not able to do these calculations because here we have not taken into account any alpha prime corrections, so I mean, we still know that the solution has vanishing cosmological constants, so it should have. This formula should hold, but I mean, what the proposed resolution is that the relationship between V and rho changes so that this continues to hold. As I said, we will try and look at D3 and D7 brains in the warped environment. So if our prime focus is going to try and see how warping affects soft Susi breaking terms. So I'll discuss the case of a single D3 brain for simplicity. The action is given by the usual sum of the Born-Enfield and the Chern-Simons piece. One can perform an expansion to the quadratic order, and one finds that the potential is given by the following term, and it has two contributions, one arising from the Ward factor and the second from the four-form potential. In order to gain some understanding, one can use the 2B equations of motion to explicitly evaluate the mass matrix. And after use of the equations of motion, one finds that the masses are proportional to the anti-imaginary self-dual fluxes. So for ISD fluxes, they vanish, again, as is expected from the no-scale structure. But now, it's important for us to understand the powers of the Ward factor. There's an explicit power of e to the power of 8a, but there are three inverse g tilde metrics associated with this dot product. And because of the shrinking conifold cycle, the g tilde metric, inverse of the g tilde metric, is really getting big, and that contributes e to the power of minus 6a, and the masses get scaled by a single power of e to the power of a. And one can, of course, do a similar calculation for D7 brains. And following Camara, Ibanez, and Uranga, one finds that there is a flux-generated contribution, and again, it is warped by a single power of the Ward factor. And this mass can, of course, be supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric, depending on the nature of the flux.
So you actually found there are soft terms for D3?
Only in the case of non-ISD fluxes. There's a lot of discussion of that in the literature. Yes, because with the hope that we can find some.
You're going to need to stabilize the kernel model.
Now let me turn to a 4D effective description. So again, the focus is going to try and get the warping dependence. In case of a Kähler potential of the following form, where I denote the hidden sector by H and the visible sector by L, a superpotential W and gauge kinetic functions F, the soft Susi breaking terms have been discussed in literature in terms of the hidden sector auxiliary waves. And so what we did is we took a Kähler potential with the following form. We included the linear piece in A from our earlier calculations. Here I have taken k alpha betas to be diagonal, and y denotes the D7 brain complex scalar, y a tilde the D3 brain complex scalars. Then for the supersymmetric case, one can go ahead and compute the potential. One finds the following expression. And for the broken Susi case, one can compute the soft soft mass, specializing the case to a diagonal ky. The feature to take from both these formulas is that the right hand side scales as a single power of a, as we saw, as required by the behavior of the microscopic calculation of the masses. And in some sense, this can be thought as a consistency check on the whole thing, because these formulas should hold in n equals to 1 supergravity. And since YA is naturally warped, one needs m3 by 2 and all the other terms to also be warped. So in summary, I would like to say that warping is a generic feature in 2B flux compactifications with many phenomenological applications. And we have found that it has many important effects on the 4D effective field theory for volumes less than the maximal warping. One sees redshifting of the masses of bulk modes and localization of wave function. We also saw that the gravitino exhibits a similar behavior. For W naught of the order of 1, one found that Suzy breaking could not be captured in a usual n equals to 1 d equals to 4 formalism. For W naught much less than 1, we could study soft terms by adding a term linear in the Kähler potential, linear in the maximal warping to the Kähler potential.
No, I mean,
we did not try and do anything more than what was done previously in the literature. I mean, all that we were trying to do is getting the warping dependence. And since, I mean, treating the warping itself is so complicated, we were not able to see any like additional structure. So, yeah, we don't know one way or the other, yes.
Well, is supersymmetry playing any special role for you other than as a, you know, kind of auxiliary device to give you more control or more understanding? I mean, is it anything essential about super, you know, this W naught goes to this?
I mean, I think it helped us, you know, kind of gain some, I mean, to use, control just to use the n equals to 1 formalism, I think that. But other than that, I don't think it played any.
Another way to ask that question is, rather someone proposes a solution to the hierarchy
right.
problem without supersymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of complications that don't by assuming supersymmetry below the Hankine scale, many of which actually don't have as many modeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you do some of this in that spirit? Is there a problem?
I mean, I think the thing is that the reason why one did not have a compactification where the, you know, the whole hierarchy is generated from the warping. So I mean, you know, we're just trying to. I'm saying that, you know, you can be either way. So we just since this condition is not really very strong. So you know, even for throats which are not. That's strongly warped, you start seeing this phenomenon. So
warping could have given W not small compared to 1, but it doesn't apparently. You're saying you have to put that in.
Yeah.
I mean, can I really ask their question? Their question is, do you see any trouble with making W not the order 1, Suzy is broken at a very high scale, and you get the whole hierarchy from warping? It's harder for you to work with, but you don't see any problem with
it. No, I don't see any problem. Yeah, I think, and in our paper, I think that, you know, there are some kind of scenarios. Yeah, so yes, there's no like, you know, fundamental problem. Yeah.
We're going to talk about phenomenology. I mean, I'm maybe asking you more than you've thought about.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were going to talk about a phenomenology of something like that, would you think of that as, would you expect that's just again, that's identical to what Randall and Sundrum.
Yes, it's very similar to Randall
or
Sundrum.
Is there anything that would be qualitatively different?
No, I think it's very similar to Randall Sundrum. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for coming.